Welcome to another episode of Intimacy Today. I'm your host, Dr. Sheena Glover. I'm excited about today's topic because you're going to hear a conversation between a colleague and I about religious trauma and how that can impact a marriage. Oftentimes, people who are deconstructing their faith, they are coming from a high-controlled religion. And one of the unfortunate drawbacks to high-controlled religion is it perpetuates a lot of shame and fear. And when a couple has to make the tough decision to walk away from their religion, it means that they are left with so many questions about their identity, what love means in the marriage and the roles that they play in the marriage, as well as how it reshapes sexuality. Joining me today is Lisa Brennan, a seasoned therapist of over 20 years of experience. And there isn't much she hasn't seen. She has helped couples and individuals help reconnect with themselves and work through the difficult parts of what it means to just be alive, be in this world. And I hope you enjoy today's episode. So what I was thinking about is why, when we look at couples and we use the word trauma around it, why does your sexuality being treated like a light switch where you're supposed to have it off the whole time you are single and you're, you know, part of the religious community, and then all of a sudden you have to turn it on the moment you are legally binded to someone, your spouse? Why do you think that that's traumatic?
I mean, it shuts down just basic human desire, basic human biological functions. I mean, you know, we it's like any feeling. We don't control a feeling coming up. I mean, some people think they do, you know, like, well, anger's not, you know, serves no purpose, so I just won't feel it. But that's not actually what happens. They feel it. You know, same with sexual desire. Mm-hmm. So it's dehumanizing. It's shutting down something that naturally happens for all of us. When those types of biological urges and all the desire, our hormones are raging, you know, right at the peak of all that, that's when high control religion usually wants to clamp that down and puts all these rules on it. And you have the purity culture, and it's all about controlling.
You know, the thing that comes to mind for me is that every time the light switch of sexuality has been turned on, immediate shame has been kind of married together with it. So if I have a thought that is sexual in nature, the religion that I'm a part of that is high control tells me that that is terrible, that I am sinning, that I'm going to go to hell. So now I have created this immediate relationship that the word on sexuality immediately means that I have committed, what, lack of a better word, crime. And so you fast forward and you're legally allowed to now have sex under the umbrella of this religion. Turning it on means that I am still committing a sin, but it's also an allowable. It's hard to kind of go into this gray space, right? Because religion, high control religion in and of itself is very binary in their thinking. And so, yeah. You know, no, there's not a preparation for that.
No. How do you shift gears in that way when you've been told something is wrong? You know, and with men, it's, they can't, their minds are evil. With women, it's their bodies are evil. So how do you shut that down? It's going to eventually play into any relationship.
Like, I want to name the fear that happens. Like, we're using the word trauma, or I at least posed it as that. Like, why does it feel so traumatic, or is traumatic for some people? Well, it's rooted in that fear of, I am doing something wrong because I am wrong based on the religion you were taught. So I've been working towards being, you know, next to
as pure as possible. And so anything that stains that sense of purity, that sense of non-sinfulness, if you will, is causing a lot of fear when you're engaging in any behavior mm-hmm. that brings that up. And what do you think about that?
Where my mind goes is more focused on maybe the woman, you know, that after mm-hmm. being told, you know, that, and there's, I think, a societal pressure, a cultural pressure, and then there's the high control religion that's kind of informing them how to be, sexually speaking, you know, so it's kind of like there's this pressure of them basically go into the Madonna whore complex. You know, you can't be a woman that wants too much sex, and you can't be a woman that doesn't want sex at all. You know, I literally saw a Facebook post the other day, and it was two pictures of two different women. And the question that was posed was, what do you think men really want? And the picture was, the first one was a woman, you know, very comfortable in her, you know, sexuality, dressed very sexy, felt, you know, good about herself. And then the other picture was a woman holding a child, you know, dressed, you know, with a you know, high mm-hmm. neckline. And there were people that were answering the question as though it was a valid question. And, you know, all I could think was, it's just so black and white, and we're still dealing with that in 2024. It's women are all of it, yet we're still mm-hmm. held to this ideal of, and both can't exist at the same time. You can't be a sexual being that loves pleasure and desire and sex and be a good mom and nurturing and, you know, everything that comes along with the more domesticated side of things.
When I think of that, those two images, that's how women are just relegated to being a sexual object or nurturer. And there's such a huge gap between that, very small roles too. If you know, depending on how a woman leads her life, she might not be a mother. She might be asexual too, you know? And so it's this idea that you could either be a vixen or a mother.
Yes.
And it's really unfortunate to see women having to like grapple with this. Like if I choose one, it automatically means I'm not mm-hmm. the other.
Yeah.
And then there's a guilt about not being one or the other as well. And it's situated around a man's experience, what the man deems it as, kind of like cornering of women that they have to constantly navigate through in this.
Right. And then, you know, add high control religion where there's, you know, lack of sex education, lack of encouraging to know your own body. You know, pleasure is feels hedonistic in high control mm-hmm. religions. Mm-hmm. Like you're not supposed to, you know, enjoy your body, enjoy sex. Put that on top of it and then get married and you're with somebody for the first time. And you believe, I think a lot of times that that's going to just come to you. You're going to know what to do. And that's not the case a lot of the time. So then it almost puts it in the spot, I think, where it becomes performative. There's a lack of intimacy that happens because nobody, you know, understands what they're actually feeling because they never explored it.
I was reading a article about sexual health among teens, like how is information actually getting to them about sexual health? And in this article, they found that the internet is the most popular place to get as much information as you can about health, because it is not being taught within like school systems. In fact, I believe there's about only 20 states that actually says that you have to provide this type of sexual education. And even within the 20 that does, they don't necessarily provide a comprehensive, a complete look at sexual health, right? So there is this glaring issue about sexual education, which is pleasure is never talked about at a very, young age of, being in your puberties and things like that. It's never talked about. It is always a consequence that you are going to get pregnant or you're going to catch a STD and it should be reserved for marriage. And so pleasure is missing the whole time in the conversation of sex. And then when we throw in high control religion, it's even more, the curriculum is definitely even more stripped than before. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about that, I think about how our body experiencing pleasure is innate. It's organic. And we've been taught to like cut off our heads from our bodies. Do not register that as pleasure. It is not supposed to be pleasurable, even though the body is sending that signal. And then you have associated that with something that you've just committed a sin for having that. It's so interesting that we're having to help couples and help individuals remind them of what pleasure is that is organic to them and not associate that with something negative. I mean, what do you think about that?
I agree. And a lot of times what I see that's unfortunate is when couples come in after years of this, because then there's a certain dynamic formed around it. There's certain ways that they learn to cope. For example, like with, say, a woman that doesn't give herself permission to be sexual, or has this idea what that's supposed to look like, or has the pressure of, I have to give my husband sex in order to, because men need sex, like women don't, which is just always, baffled me. But, they have this idea and they end up having sex when they don't really want to. Maybe they're stressed, right? But they feel like if they don't, then it almost gives their husbands permission to seek it elsewhere, because society has this idea that men need sex and women don't. And if you don't, then there's going to be this consequence. And I see a lot of women that fear that. And then they end up having sex when they don't want to, which I look at as a betrayal to themselves, right? And how do they get through that? It kind of goes back to what you're saying a minute ago. It's like they have to repeat what they did when they were younger. They cut themselves off from it. They dissociate whatever they have to do.
Exactly. Like when I first came to Texas and had the whole experience with working with individuals who may have like removed themselves from their religion, a lot of women were having obligatory sex. And if we like look at that and peel back the layers a little bit, there is sexual trauma that can occur, where that you even use the word disassociation, like to give your body to someone because you don't believe your body is yours. It's to your husband. Right. I want to give the benefit of the doubt to the spouses, particularly in these high control religious couple who deconstructed. They're oftentimes heterosexual, cisgender, men and women. And so even the men, they don't realize that they might be also perpetuating sexual trauma without the kind of the intentions of creating sexual trauma. But it is when the one partner doesn't want sex, that they've been taught that their body is for someone else's pleasure and they have to just kind of give in. Like that becomes so murky in that space. Yeah. And it feels really, it can feel really uncomfortable and a really shameful is what I've seen.
Yeah. And kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, for men, I do think that they also have been abused in that way, as far as lack of education, not understanding, and this idea that this is what it's going to look like. This is what it's going to look like when you get married. And what we were talking about earlier is when, then I think men do struggle with, well, maybe what's wrong with me, or does my wife love me? are not enough, you know, that this isn't the way that it's playing out, you know? And mm-hmm. I think that is mm-hmm. what leads to them perpetuating the whole thing, right? Being maybe more expressive in that arena, when I think really what's missing kind of across the board is just is intimacy, that closeness, because they're both going off of an idea of what sex is supposed to be according to what they learned or what somebody told them versus experience. And they're coming out of growing up where, like you were saying earlier, pleasure's denied. You have to fit in a certain box, you know. Men, you can't look at a woman and have thoughts about her because that is a sin. You know, women, you can't, you know, be comfortable in your own body because that is a sin. And then they get married and they have this idea of what sex is and they try to have that, but it's not mm-hmm. actual intimacy and closeness and trust and allowing desire and organic unfolding of where that leads to and just enjoying each other. It's this whole other thing that they're both creating.
Mm-hmm. The immediate thought I have is like sex then becomes very mechanical when you're trying to achieve what it's supposed to be. I really like that. Like sex for couples that are struggling in this way, very unique way, it becomes really mechanical. Like, am I supposed to be doing this? How am I supposed to be doing that? And a lot of people actually develop such severe anxiety, like either right before or right after. And I, you know, for those who are not, you know, familiar with having anxiety before or after sex, it's catastrophic about a lot of these men and women who have sex for the first time under those conditions of like meeting the criteria. Am I hitting all the marks of what it's supposed to be? Like, am I giving pleasure? Am I not? Did I do this right? Oh, that's so terrible. It's kind of like having Jesus in your bedroom, like telling you, that looks like mm-hmm. you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's so much pressure to put on anybody, let alone a couple who've been together, you know, up to that point, maybe a year or two before they get married, and they don't know this side of themselves.
Right. Yeah. They don't. They have given their authority around their own body to God and other people in the religion, like, you know, had to dictate what it's supposed mm-hmm. to be, and have cut themselves off from really understanding how they're enjoying it. And then even, I think, fearful of asking for what they want, even with their spouses. I think it turns into, at least sort of here, you know, this fear of, well, if I ask for that, am I going to be viewed in a certain way? You know, if I allow myself to have pleasure, it has to be in a box because that might make me look like a slut. You know, that might, and mm-hmm. my husband may judge me for that. Or, you know, if a man, I don't know, approaches his wife in a certain way and, you know, she may feel objectified. But what ends up happening is that they both end up objectifying each other in different ways.
That is really good. I like that. They end up objectifying each other.
It's like what you're saying, more about the performance of it. Like, am I doing it right? There's just so much insecurity around it because there's never been sex education. There's never been just an allowing of each person to figure themselves out, their own pleasure and allow desire and all that, that they only can go on what they've been told or what they find in different places, possibly, like in watching pornography. Okay, well, this is what sex is supposed to look like. Okay, this is what sex looks like when we're enjoying it, you know? And mm-hmm. and yet there's a problem with it too, because that's not right. So now there's a struggle there. It's like, well, what is sex really supposed to be? What am I supposed to feel? I don't even know what I'm supposed to feel having sex. Like, You know what I mean? Like, there's such a disconnection.
It makes me like think of like couples, like how do they even start to have conversations around that? You know, something that I read just the other day is about like, it was a research done on women. They happen to be young women in heterosexual relationships, and about communicating sexual desires while simultaneously avoiding sexual conflict. So the conclusion of this research is that the more you are softer, that you provide like positive feedback of like what's done right, adding jokes and humor for those awkward parts. And then, you know, not the timing can lead to like better conversations about sexual discrepancies without creating conflict. And so I thought that was a brilliant article. It's, you know, missing some things, like they don't have a men's perspective. They only gathered it from like women's perspective. And it makes me think about, okay, if we were to put that into like a toolbox for couples who are in this exact situation, they've deconstructed their faith, but they just need some help on talking about it. Like, my first thought is, how could I help them? What would be the most effective way about it? And in the first place that I go to is like a sense of safety. How do I feel safe talking to, you know, my spouse or my partner about something that could really hurt me and my partner? Because sex is such a vulnerable thing. It's a very vulnerable, you know, intimate, sacred experience for you and your partner.
Right.
So it's really tricky. It's a really tricky territory. And so safety, like, what do you think about when I, you know, when you think of safety, of how do I create a safe environment to actually have these conversations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing that comes to mind is giving each other space to be honest. You know, that I read recently a paper on, it was, I think it's Psychology Today, but it was talking about people that they find have the most, I guess, ability. I don't know if that's the right word, but that often lie is what it came down to. Mm. And the statistically, it is people that come from high control religions that have skills around not being truthful. And I say it that way because, yeah, they've had to be in a lot of instances, right? You know, because there was never a space for them to be honest about their feelings. Mm-hmm. They've only been allowed to feel a certain feelings. Had to clamp mm-hmm. down on that. And if they were asked a question that they knew was going to lead them to getting into trouble in some way, right? Which is most things in high control religion. I mean, you're you know, not allowed to do anything outside of a very strict, very strict parameters of, you know, just being human, you know, like have mm-hmm. desire. You better not, you know, watch pornography, you know, all these different things that if somebody asked, they would say no, right? Why would you tell the truth if you know where it's going? And I think mm-hmm. a lot of times couples aren't honest with each other. And so the very first thing is they have to start being honest, and that creates safety. They have to take a risk around mm-hmm. being really truthful about what they really feel, you know, because kind of what you were saying about that article, like they try to avoid the conflict. You know, I think we've talked about this before. You know, I don't worry about couples that are fighting because I see it as just two sides of the same coin. They're still invested. There's passion there. They care about it. It's indifference, you know, and it's almost as though, you know, when there's not safety to be honest and you can't be truthful about your real feelings, you don't give that other person even an opportunity to get to know you.
Ooh, I love that. Not an opportunity to get to know you. And you know what? There is also this glaring issue that they don't know themselves either. Mm-hmm. They've been, experiencing a religion that tells them that you were, there's this acronym called JOY that I learned from this book called When Religion Hurts. And it's Jesus first, others second, you last. And those are the three, kind of the order in which you're supposed to know and think of yourself last. You're not allowed to think about your feelings or know your feelings because others matter more. And then you primarily, Jesus is first. So it's very interesting if we were to put this into context, like my partner doesn't know me because I've had to kind of conceal myself for the sake of the religion, but then also they haven't been, you know, experienced in getting to know themselves as mm-hmm. well. That would be really, you know, that is very tricky just to kind of unpack that. So it just makes me think a person in that position will first need to do their own work before like coming into the space of like, how do I co-create safety with my partner when looking at our sex life in couples therapy? You know, what do you think?
I agree. It's hard to know what to ask for or what you need with your partner if you don't know, because you don't know yourself. So it seems like you would need mm-hmm. to answer those questions first and then mm-hmm. take the risk in sharing it and be vulnerable. You know, vulnerability is the portal to intimacy. Without vulnerability, you can't feel closer to another person. And yet vulnerability is really scary because I think coming from a high control religion, you know, the threat is eternity, that you'll spend it in hell. This is what, you know, they're taught coming from a high control religion. If you do things outside of this box, you could possibly spend eternity in hell. And I know plenty of clients that intellectually know that is absurd, and they, you know, don't believe it. It's not a belief that they hold anymore. Yet, because it was a trauma and it was taught at such an impressionable age, they still feel it. It will still come up, and it's still something to fight through, you know? So to express to your partner, like, I would like this in bed, right? When they've been taught that that's something to be shameful of, or, you know, judge them in some way around it, it'd be really hard to ask for such a vulnerable thing. You have to really trust that your partner's not going to judge you because you're already fighting all these other things internally.
If both people don't treat this moment as really precious mm-hmm. and very fragile, it can cause so many setbacks like along the way. And, you know, something that I've learned in understanding this field is, or this kind of experience, this is shame. Shame is a great protector. It's maybe not the most helpful protector, but it's the way in which takes you away from feeling the injustice of this all, the frustration. Instead, if you can just blame yourself, if you can think that you're at fault, you have a little bit more control. And so I've seen couples in my work where, you know, that shame shows up and it hijacks the conversation, and then it gets stuck there for a while. So if both people are not ready to treat this as delicately as possible, there, you know, you just are experiencing one setback after the other. Yeah. And, you know, and it's, I think, in my opinion, I think that's just sad to see that they have to do this really delicate, you know, dance to not trigger while also simultaneously trying to be vulnerable. Like, it is not hard to go from a place of lying, really, to be being dishonest because you know what the consequences are, to taking that risk of vulnerability and saying, can I like it when, or can I have more of this, or can we do this? And if your partner is not receptive or feel criticized by that request, mm-hmm. that is just so gutting for both people involved, and they're just triggering each other's shame.
You're making me think of the book Come As You Are by Emily Nagoski. She has a quiz mm-hmm. in there that talks about, she talks about it in the context of it being like putting your foot on the gas versus putting your foot on the brake. And it's a really good quiz for couples, I think, to discuss with each other, because it, a lot of times we're not aware of these little things that could be turning us off or causing us to dissociate because it's triggering our nervous system, right? Because of past trauma around sex, you know, while in the midst of sex, you know, it might be a sound that your partner makes, or, you know, a smell, or maybe a thought that creeps in, you know, and these things can create dissociation right away, where now you're not connected to the experience anymore. Now it's become something that does feel more obligatory. And I, you know, I think one of the things that I see is really helpful when couples are beginning to kind of break down the dynamic that they've been in around sex is to give each other permission to stop in the middle when something comes up. You know, to allow that space to be like, hey, I need to take a moment. And that can be, I think, so important in building trust and safety and connection and bonding between them, to say, you know, hey, that reminded me of something and I need to take a moment, and but just to hold each other and give that space and not feel like it has to continue, or that, you know, there's this pressure to not and allow for what's really coming up in the moment to be so present, you know, and going back to what you're saying earlier about having to work on our own personal selves, you know, I think it is around identity, but also learning what works for us and de-escalating our nervous systems when they are triggered and they're going to be triggered around sex. I mean, I don't know how you pull that apart, you know, without using more defense mechanisms, right? So you have this sexual abuse is what I would call it, especially if you've gone through purity culture, right? But even if that wasn't a thing, you know, that, you know, you come from a different generation, there's still sexual abuse that happens because of the fact that you're taught you can't be a sexual being. I mean, that's the bottom line. You know, you can't be, because it's shameful, and you can't have desire, and you shouldn't engage in pleasure because all of it is shameful, and you're going to go to hell if you engage in it. You know, that's, to me, is abusive. That's sexual abuse. So when you do get to a place where you are trying to have a healthy sexual relationship with your spouse or anyone, you know, I think it is going to trigger you. I don't know how it doesn't. So, you know, going back to what you're saying about safety, I think that knowing your own nervous system and how it's triggered, what are your triggers? Giving yourself space, and your spouse, your partner giving you space to allow for that to come up, being in the moment. I think it's the only way to create that and to get in touch too with your own pleasure.
Goodness, what you just said, like I have like three avenues that I'm going to take. So, oh my goodness. Okay. So the thought that I had, and I love that, to slow down when you notice that you're disembodied, that you are disassociating, or you're no longer in your body. That's what it, you know, I think of. And you and I had a conversation about this before, about using the analogy of the room in our homes. Like, how does someone like become disembodied, disassociate from their bodies? Like, the way that you and I talked about it was, imagine that you are a house, and in your house, there are several rooms, and a lot of those rooms have cautionary tape. It tells you to turn around. This is toxic. This is bad. And some of these rooms represent your inner experience, your unique experience of something. So let's imagine one of those rooms, the door to pleasure, has mold, black mold on the door, and it has cautionary tape and crime scene tape and all of that. It teaches you that you are not allowed to look inward. You must stay outside of your house and see how everybody else is perceiving you, because to turn inward and actually allow yourself to have like a pleasurable thought, a sexual thought, freeing thoughts about yourself is considered a sin. So we learn to be outside of ourselves, outside of our home, if you will. And so when I think about what you said about that moment of, you know, of a sexual experience between, you know, this couple, and something reminds them of the trauma of their past, that sexual abuse that they experienced from purity culture, that moment of, oh, I'm no longer in my house, I'm outside of my house. Like, think of having that visual helps to say, wow, how did I get outside of my house? I need to slow down and kind of walk myself back in. And that's the kind of the other point that I was thinking of, was like that giving yourself permission to slow down. How did I get here? How did we get to this space where I don't feel connected with you in this moment of vulnerability or intimacy? And, you know, I love that analogy. What are your thoughts on that?
I remember that. I love that. Yeah. How do you get to a place where you feel safe enough to walk back in? And what do you need to create? Maybe safety again, or a foundation. That's a different foundation, right? So that you can enter those rooms.
You know, the first thought that I have is like, you know, those doors that, like the one that I describe for pleasure, is, I said black mold and like cautionary tape. That's the shame. It gives the impression that these doors are off limits to you, not because that they are, but because that's what has been conditioned. That is what's been taught, you know, for a lot of these men and women.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, it's just procreation, you know, like as one element. Something that is why we still exist is because people had sex. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That would be seen as something ugly, right? Or shameful. Mm-hmm. But also pleasure. You know, it was made that way for a reason, right? I mean, you know, so mm-hmm. that we engage in it, so that we can continue to exist. So it just seems mm-hmm. weird, you know, and that's where you can see how much it's about control. You know, if you can control mm-hmm. people in this way, you can mm-hmm. control their pleasure, how they feel about themselves, if they believe that they're evil.
That is why it's called sexual abuse. I think that that's a perfect framework for what has happened, is because someone else is assigning value or devaluing parts of your experiences and or your body, and saying what is and what isn't healthy or good, and that they have a say of when your body can be used versus not. Notice that you're not a part of the equation. You're not even thought of. Does this feel good? Does this not feel good? Do you want this? When those questions are not being asked, it is sexual right. abuse. And something I learned, you know, just kind of going into this niche experience with couples, is the pendulum swing that happens mm-hmm. for couples who have deconstructed. When they get to that point of sex, everything was prescribed before, when they were a part of the religion. Like, you're allowed to have sex when this happens, and this is how it's supposed to be done, and who's supposed to gain pleasure from it, and all of that. And then once they deconstruct, they go into the pendulum swing, and it's just the opposite of the prescription. It's still prescribed mm-hmm. of, you know, what is and what isn't. And that does not necessarily liberate you or give you like the empowerment, because doing the opposite of something is not inherently the best choice. It's what is intrinsically and consciously felt within you to kind of determine that, like, you're the compass, not just doing the opposite right. of what was assigned.
Yeah, whether you're appeasing or rebelling, something's controlling your behavior. It's not coming from an autonomous place. And, you know, I often think too that people will consider that they have deconstructed their religion because they no longer take part in church or they don't believe a few different things. But I think deconstructing is a lifelong, honestly, process for people. I think it's like an onion and you're just constantly peeling back new layers to it, you know? And I think sex can be it can be a tell, like a poker tell, right? Mm-hmm. Like a tell to what's happening in your relationship in a bigger way. I think because if you look at it holistically, it's just one avenue or one area. But if you look at the way that sex is, it usually points to communication, closeness, intimacy in other ways, and where a couple's at, not just about sex.
Something you and I were talking about earlier was about what brings couples that have deconstructed into therapy. Mm-hmm. And it is oftentimes the elephant in the room, which is sex. We're not having it. It doesn't feel right. We're always getting into arguments or shutting down altogether. And I just feel really helpless. And when you and I were talking about it, you know, like you brought up a really good point about sometimes as you're deconstructing, you have built this whole life with a whole slew of attention grabbing things like your job, kids, just household stuff and responsibilities. And sex just gets moved further and further back until at some point or another, it no longer serves the relationship, or it didn't serve it in the beginning. However, it's kind of creating pressures into the relationship.
I think it's an easier in the moment, although I don't think it's easier in the big picture, but it's an easier thing to put on the back burner. Like, oh, I'm tired. Oh, mm-hmm. The kids, I have my job. You know, I don't feel like it. But I think that the avoidance of it is a bigger picture issue than it actually being that. Because I think that if a lot of times, not always, but you know, I think it's a reflection. I think that's the word I was looking for before. It's like a reflection of what's happening on a bigger scale. You know, where, you know, how honest is the couple with each other around other things besides sex, right? Where else are they living in an obligatory way or maybe playing out roles that really don't interest them, but this is what they feel they should be doing, you know? And then that shows up in sex.
Ooh, I had read this quote as I was learning about like sex therapy. And it's a quote by Esther Perel. She says, "Tell me how you were loved as a child and I will tell you how you have sex."
Ooh.
That was, when I read that, I was like, record scratch. You're really thinking about that. That quote comes to mind because in a relationship, oftentimes you don't just have this one sliver of a problem and everything else is just copacetic. It's amazing. No, it permeates into other aspects. And it's, you know, sex, there is this, you know, automatic, it's supposed to be enjoyable. It's supposed to be a good thing. Why isn't it for us? And that just illuminates the problem.
When you're talking about sex education earlier, I would, if I hadn't shared this with you before, I probably would have shared the story of when Alexander was in seventh grade, they had sex education one day at school. And their idea of sex education was to scare the living shit out of the students. So what they did was they had a video. And they showed different examples of different STIs. And, you know, Alexandra struggles with eye stuff. If anybody gets poked in the eye or anything, she passes out. Well, they put on the screen a discussion of gonorrhea of the eye. And Alexandra said she was sitting there and she says, "Mom, I was thinking mind above matter," because she felt herself starting to pass out. She starts to black, the stars are, she starts to black out. She had gum in her mouth. She says, last thing she remembers is saying, "Spit out the gum," because she choke on the gum. And she hit the floor so hard that they had to call me and I had to rush her to the hospital to make sure she didn't have a concussion. But this is the point that I was going to say. And this is in Texas. Okay. This is in Keller, Texas. I go to the nurse's office where there are many students, all green because of being nauseous and sick and everything from this video. And I go up to Alexandra and I was like, you know, getting her ready to bring her to the hospital. And the counselor comes in and went up to her to check on her. And when she said, "Well, I saw the video and it, you know, made me pass out," the counselor said to her, "Well, then you'll learn not to have sex."
Wow.
So I, of course, had a whole different discussion with her on the way to the hospital, you know, that I was shocked that they use scare tactics like that in order to make young people, you know, that are entering into, you know, different hormonal stages and they're starting to feel desire and sexual, instead of actually educating them on that and their bodies and everything else, they're putting these scare tactics on video. And I'm not kidding. There were over a dozen students in the nurse's office that had either vomited, looked green, passed out.
Wow. I find myself wanting to laugh. I'm so sorry to hear, like, Alexandra and those kids. Oh, that's so sad. I'm just visualizing. It's not funny that they're sick. It was just the way that, but you know, that frustrates me when I hear it, because what next? Like, let's imagine that that's all you ever learn about sex, is that you are going to get gonorrhea of the eyeballs.
Right.
At what point does the message change? These individuals who are creating these curriculums and using fear tactics, do they ever stop to think, okay, when they officially arrive at age 20 or 18, we're going to have the talk again about sex, but this is what it actually is, or here's what you missed the first time I told you that you might not catch STDs if you know how to do safe sex. And it's that short-sightedness that drives me nuts. And then immediately I think about, like, social psychology, you know, like there's this perspective of how do you persuade someone or a group of people to follow your message? Fear. And you have to not only be persuaded by the fear, you also have to give them a way out. If they follow the following plans, then they can avoid this bad thing from happening. Right. And so when we use fear to drive home a point, what is the end destination? You know, it's like they're not thinking about how the influence or how the impact, the ripple effect of that teaching will have. If it wasn't for you, your daughter could have held on to that very traumatic and physically hurtful moment and then would have maintained that belief for who knows for how long before someone challenged it.
It does speak to what we're seeing today. We're getting to a place where there's going to be less births than deaths. You know what I mean? Like, there's going to, you know, we're going to have less population. I see the generations, like when I was in my 20s, I don't know if I really felt that. I never really thought about having children, not having children. You know, I just never thought about it. Mm-hmm. But you see, you know what I mean? It was going to be whatever it was. It wasn't something that I gave thought to. But I literally see younger generations thinking about it. Do I want to have children? Do I not want to have, you know, like it's, and a lot of people saying they don't want to have children. Now, I know this isn't totally related to sex, but you kind of, it could, there could be a portion of it that is, you know.
I bet. I think that that would be a really great, like a whole episode on how these teachings might have inadvertently created that. Now, I don't know if I'm going to put that in in the podcast, you know, but I think that that's a phenomenal kind of question.
Yeah.
When Lisa and I met, we met in Southlake, Texas, and I had moved from California where I got most of my training, and Lisa had been here for years by then. But one of the things that I found very interesting about my time when I first got to Texas was how much religion had played a role in people's sexuality, namely within the LGBTQ. So I felt like I had been like teleported back to the 50s, where I had clients who were really weary about disclosing their sexual orientation for what felt like months before they finally disclosed, because they were afraid that I would convert or judge them or start talking about religion. And then this opened the door for how much religion had impacted women. Some of the individual clients before I started exclusively working with couples, how it was impacting these women feeling like they had to have obligatory sex because their religion had really created that mindset. So Lisa and I kind of share similar experiences, wanting to really support the men and women who are in this unique experience where they have already deconstructed their faith. And now they're looking to rebuild their relationship, their marriage, where it isn't kind of impacted by their religion telling them that they should be ashamed of who they are for what they want, what they desire. You know, in saying all of that, what has been your experience, Lisa, in terms of this very unique experience that I've seen here in Texas, but I imagine in other like Bible Belt states or other, you know, parts of the United States where religion, high control religion, can really impact a person's sense of safety and sexuality?
I moved to Texas from Massachusetts, and Massachusetts is very liberal, not part of the Bible Belt. And one of the very first things I noticed when I moved here originally was how much religion was integrated into everything in the South. You know, people, I used to refer to it as they wear it on their sleeve. It's like something that makes them feel a part of a group. And it was very hard to feel part of a community when I was not in religion, in a religion. You know, I grew up Catholic, and in the South, they don't consider Catholics Christians. That's what I was told. You know, yeah. And, you know, I don't follow Catholicism. I don't, you know, I deconstructed my own religion years ago, but it was something that really stood out to me, how ostracized I felt, you know, how othered I felt. And it just stuck with me.
What about your experience in therapy, like your clients? What drew you into this kind of wanting to work with this particular population?
One of the things that I noticed when I first started working in individual practice was how many people were coming to me and finding me because I was not quote unquote Christian counselor, that there was a lot of fear. And a lot of the clients that did come in were part of possibly the LGBT group, or, you know, were involved in, you know, or part of maybe an open marriage or more polyamorous relationships, and were afraid to be seen by a Christian counselor because they felt they would be judged and led down a certain path that they didn't want to go down. And I realized how much, as I worked with people, you know, I realized how much it permeated their entire life growing up in the high control religions, how it was, I think, at the core, what we touched on earlier, which was not being connected to themselves, really not knowing themselves from a really young age, being taught that they had to be a certain way, period. And if they weren't, they were abused. This is my words, you know, abused, because I don't know any other situation where a monster is presented to a child in the way the devil's presented to children. And this idea that you're going to go to hell and for eternity if you're not good according to the religion, that's acceptable. I mean, you know, they put bans on movies and lyrics and songs, and now they're banning books and everything else, right? But that is okay. And that to me is abusive. And I think it then sets the stage for there to be a lack of connection to self, a lack of knowing how you feel about all kinds of things. But when we start to get involved in, you know, the discussion of intimacy and sex, it plays out. And I think in today's day and age where the patriarchy and some of the other things, you know, traditional ways of living are being challenged so deeply, women in particular, but I think men and women really in the big picture, you know, are rejecting these things. It's like, okay, but how do I replace this? What do I do now? You know, I grew up with this. This is affecting me. Like I don't want to feel shame around sex, but I do. I don't want to be turned off by my husband watching pornography, but I am. I have these desires, but I may see my husband in a certain light because of, you know, but I don't know how to work past that. I don't know what to do about that. And it just started to become more eye-opening for me that how much it affects people's whole lives, you know, and a lot of times these things are put off because, you know, you're raised this way. Then you hit your 20s, maybe you marry the person you've been in love with and you didn't have sex before marriage. And you believe it's going to be a certain way and then it's not, but you put it on the back burner. Maybe you have a couple kids, you know, life goes on. And then you hit, you know, possibly 30s and you start to question, you start to get into this, you know, like, what, wait a minute, is this what it's supposed to look like forever? I don't want this. This is not what I want. I want to experience other things in my life. And they start to question, people start to question it. Clients come in, you know, for all kinds of reasons. You know, I think sex is the one that I see most often be brought in, but I think it's a symptom to a bigger picture. But I think it's the one that people get to a place and they think, I want to experience something different than what I'm experiencing in that arena. And it's easier to point out and say, well, I'm not feeling free sexually. I'm not feeling pleasure. I'm unable to be in the moment, unable to experience it in the way that I really want to. And there's a lot of questions that come up around that, right? With maybe what's wrong with me, you know, how do I change this? And some people might divorce at that time or leave or, you know, look for other ways, you know, when really I think at the core of it is intimacy with self. How can you be intimate and honest and forthcoming with someone else when you haven't been able to be that for yourself, with yourself, because you were told to reject a big part of yourself growing up?
You know, though, something that just hit when I think about couples, like, why is it that sex is the primary issue, you know, or a large issue? And, you know, they might actually talk about, you know, disconnection in the relationship, difficulties with communication. Sex is the only area in the whole of the relationship that feels very much like the religion. And this is just off the top of my head. Think about it from that perspective. that's the area. They could be good in everything else in that religion, right? Be, you know, giving, charitable, read the scripture, read the Bible, read the doctrines, right? Practice, regurgitate. Now, take that and put it next to inside of a marriage. I can pay the bill. I can be the provider. But sex in both contexts of both when you are a part of that religion and you are in the marriage, it still felt the same. That's the one immovable. Even if you're having sex, it still feels the same. That shame still feels the same. And I think that that's why so many people come in. What do you think about that?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's like, it's the red flag. You know, it's the things wrong. Because, yeah, in every other area, they can do all the things that you just mentioned. But when it comes to sex, I mean, sex kind of forces, because what you said earlier, sex is so vulnerable. And it can be, if it's not treated in that way and treated as a sacred connection, you know, I think it goes back to what you're saying about safety. You know, you really do need to feel, everybody, whether you've grown up in a high control religion or not, you know, sex demands safety. Mm-hmm. Now you can have sex without safety, but you are going to have a guard up. You are going to be protecting yourself in some way. You might be able to, you know, experience, say, an orgasm, right? Even though you're protected and all that. And then you might believe that it might be good sex, but you're not connecting with that other person. It's not sacred anymore. It's very objectified, performative. It's, you know, it's something that people are just doing, you know, with each other versus experiencing that connection. And you can't do that without vulnerability. So you can have sex without safety, but you're not going to have good sex without safety.
Yeah. And also to feel safe is also to feel empowered too, by the way. So empowerment is a really good indicator that you are doing something for you. If you're not feeling empowered, maybe that opens the door of, do I actually feel safe? Is this making me feel comfortable, you know, in that experience?
Ooh, I like that. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Do you feel empowered? And I don't think, you know, at least in my experience in working with couples, I don't think that either really feel empowered in that arena at all or safe. Mm-hmm. I think there's a desire to feel that, but then there's this question mark of how to do that. And I think that what happens, and tell me if this has been your experience, but I know in the beginning of working with people on an individual level, right, that come in a lot of the focus can be around what can you control and what can't you control? Because I think a lot of times what happens is people will first try to control the other person. Well, if they just do this, then I can feel comfortable. You know, if mm-hmm. they just do that, I can feel safe. And you can't, right? You can't control another person. So I think it's more around focusing on connecting with yourself, having insight around what it is that you feel, you desire, how you would like it to be, taking risks around being vulnerable. And that's a big ask. That's a big ask. Mm-hmm.
I love what you said about like focusing on someone else, if they would do that, is actually you taking the power literally out of your hand and putting it into mm-hmm. another being. That is like perpetuating what you've had to endure in your religion. Put it in God's hands. If you just pray enough, or if you do this X, Y, and Z, then, and it's everything really outside of you, because like that JOY acronym that I mentioned, you know, Jesus first, other second, you last, waiting for your partner to do X, Y, and Z before you feel safe. That formula no longer works. And that's something that I noticed when working with couples in this experience with religion and deconstructing, is that their previous experience being so complex and so enmeshed with their identity, their sexuality, their definition of love, you find instances of these religious bindings in so many small areas of your life. And you're like, oh, another one. Right. This is another time my religion is getting to me, you know. And it definitely feels frustrating, and also, so it makes you kind of feel helpless and hopeless when you see that another thing that reminds you or that you're replicating of your religious kind of teachings, when you see it, it can be very discouraging. But to struggle with it means that you're trying to move forward. Acquiescing and not having any struggles also, you know, might mean that either you're not aware of the problem having existed, or, you know, you still need to kind of develop insight around that, you know?
Yeah.
So
I love that. The very thing that I think couples avoid, which is, and of course safety needs to be created in that, but is to just be authentic and in the moment when it comes to sex, because it's the masks that are the turnoffs, right? It's the mask they feel like they have to wear in that, the thing that they feel they should be in that moment, which is the turnoffs, because the turn-ons are the things that are you taking care of you and your own pleasure with the other person as well. You know, like when either person is responding to the other one with desire and that attraction and all that, it's what is a turn on to the other partner. So if you take care of your own pleasure in that way, like know yourself and allow yourself to feel it and be in the moment, that's the very thing, right? There's no way to perform that. There's no way to perform that and have the same experience. It's just not going to, it doesn't exist. It's the actual allowing in the moment and allowing the attraction and desire. And that is what fuels the other person. And we're just talking about desire, right? And then, of course, the vulnerability and the safety and the honesty is what creates more intimacy.
I'm glad we've made it to the end of this wonderful episode of exploring the impact that religious trauma can have on your sexuality and your sexual experiences in your marriage. If you want to learn more about today's episode, head on over to Intimacy in Progress, where you will get a lot more information about the topic, as well as a treatment that Lisa and I offer for those who are undergoing deconstruction in their faith as a married couple. And I put out episodes every other week. So I will talk to you then, and have a wonderful day.